Hello and welcome to Lasting Values. I'm today's host, James Gifford, Head of Sustainable and Impact Advisory at Credit Suisse. And we're running a three-part podcast series about climate technologies you never knew existed.
I'm Michael van der Meer, Head of Sustainable Investment Analysts at Credit Suisse. Now, when we talk about the energy transition, we tend to think solar, wind, and electric vehicles. But these technologies by themselves are not enough to get us to net zero. What we've seen is that there's a long tail of emerging technologies that we think will need to help address climate change. And many of us won't even have heard of these technologies, but they could, together, make a really big difference.
We need so much energy, it's ridiculous. And we need not just a technological breakthrough, we need multiple technological breakthroughs. And we need government support, and we need an unbelievable amount of capital. And then we need to very quickly roll this out. If you read Vaclav Smil's books, historically, it takes around 100 years or 150 years even for humanity to transition from one energy source to another. And we're talking about doing it in 20 or 25 years here.
That's Kevin Bonebrake from Quaise Energy, who we'll be hearing from in a short while. Because today, we're joined by three startups that will be bringing to market some exciting climate technologies. As something already out there, but probably unbeknown to most, let's start with virtual power plants. We welcome Greg Dixon from Voltus, which integrates so-called distributed energy resources to the grid.
Distributed energy resources, and I'm going to call them DERs for short, are electricity consuming, producing, and storing devices that lie behind electricity meters at commercial, institutional, industrial, and residential locations that can be controlled in real time through the internet.
So let's see if I've got this. If you're a household and let's say you have a Tesla battery and solar panels on the roof, this device would link with the grid and work out when you should put energy back into the grid and at what times, and then you get paid.
That's exactly right. So, you know, you have a smart thermostat in your home on the wall, an EV in your garage, solar on your roof. Your business or your company may have an on-site generator providing backup power to its data centers, cold storage facilities, which in aggregate represent the single largest energy storage system in the world, are a DER. And these DERs, they lie in plain sight, really, in every facet of our work and our home lives. And when we aggregate and we orchestrate with technology these DERs, we create these things called virtual power plants. And the significance of VPPs is that it's estimated that virtual power plants will eventually capture more than 50% of the $3.2 trillion annual global electricity spend of human beings.
Voltus seems like a really great example of how smart software is needed for the energy transition, just as much as raw production of electrons and energy storage solutions that are more well known. I'm keen to know how these virtual power plants might develop.
Well, you know, we can draw on lots of analogies to describe where distributed energy resources or DERs and VPPs are going. We like the analogy of computing. You know, when you go back to the 70s, computing was defined by mainframes and what were known as dumb terminals. And we all know since then, innovation has brought computing to our smartphones and our laptops and to the edge, and most recently to the cloud, along with the internet. And those technologies, those innovations, the digitization distribution, if you will, has revolutionized every facet of our lives. Interestingly enough, the original network, which is the electrical grid, has not evolved until now. In the future, what we will see is a similar transformation where we go from a central power generation station and dumb buildings and homes model to smaller, distributed, intelligent energy resources, these DERs, that create much more economical, resilient and sustainable grids that really define the future of electricity and energy in the decades to come.
So if somebody installs your device in their house, which combines their various energy resources, can they interface with the grid now? Or would people need upgrades from the utility companies or regulatory frameworks to be put in place to make this work?
Well, from a technological perspective, the answer is yes. Most consumers today, all consumers today have a DER, including the smartphone, that might be plugged into the wall. That smartphone can be used as a demand response resource, even though it's at a micro scale. But we have 250 million smartphones in the US. All of them can be controlled in real time. So we all, in fact, have DERs in our homes. It could be a Google Nest thermostat. It could be a Generac backup generator. It could be the EV in your garage. So the technology is in every home today, as long as there's an internet connection. That's actually not the hard part. The hard part is the regulatory arena.
That raises an interesting point. One of the things that stands out to me is the complicated relationship that startups have with the regulatory environment. But we can't wait for policy changes to happen in a vacuum. Tech firms need to develop viable technologies that challenge the status quo. It's only then that you realize you can challenge policymakers to change the rules to let you operate effectively in an incumbent market.
We operate in a highly balkanized electricity market. You can drive from Stamford, Connecticut through New York City to Newark, New Jersey in about an hour, and you will cross three entirely different wholesale power markets that each have their own 7,000-page open access transmission tariff, yet the physics of electricity in those markets operate identically. This complexity of our electricity markets, which has a very interesting history in and of itself, is really the major barrier to allowing consumers to be part of the solution of making our grids less expensive, more resilient, and more sustainable. So that's actually boring, but it's a huge barrier that needs to be addressed, the regulatory environment.
Let's move to another type of new tech, batteries. And we're not talking about batteries that you use in appliances. We're talking about big battery plants that can store massive amounts of renewable energy for days at a time. A decarbonized clean energy system needs this type of storage. Renewable energy is variable, and we're going to need a lot of storage to trap energy to use when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. Here's Ted Wiley from Form Energy. The company has started a number of pilots to roll out an iron air battery, which may unlock the challenge of long-duration storage.
Form Energy is developing multi-day rechargeable iron air batteries. And in a nutshell, what that means is we are rusting and unrusting iron. We're rusting iron and then reversibly unrusting it, taking it back to iron metal. When the iron is rusting, that's discharging. And then when the iron that's oxidized is reducing, that's charging. The reason that's exciting is because iron is one of the most mined and produced materials on the planet, and therefore one of the lowest cost. In fact, we think we can take this battery on a per megawatt basis to less than a tenth the cost of any currently commercially available storage.
The charge and discharge cycle that Ted mentioned sounds like it could have some inefficiencies. But am I right in thinking that even if a lot of energy is lost, there's going to be so much capacity at certain times of production of solar and wind that we might as well just capture it with this very cheap solution?
That's exactly right. If you can get to an order of magnitude lower cost, then it's okay to tolerate some losses of the renewable energy.
Lithium-ion batteries do a similar job, and the price point of that has come down massively. I'm keen to know how they compare to your iron air batteries.
We do think that there is a place for lithium ion on the grid. And in addition to being an important solution for vehicles, that short duration storage is going to be a piece of the puzzle. Our modeling shows that, that there's high value in being able to do rapid discharging and provide power to the grid for the kind of 0 to 4 hours that lithium ion does today. What lithium ion is not really suited to is discharging for 100 hours continuously to mitigate a multi-day reliability event caused by, for example, a storm system. To be optimized for that, the pricing would have to go from something on the order of $2,000 per kilowatt hour times the number of hours, 4 hours. Well, it's down, perhaps now around 300. It would need to get to something like less than 30, perhaps less than 10. And that's what we're targeting. And I don't think lithium ion has the entitlement to get there. Just the chemicals inside the battery are around $35 per kilowatt hour. The chemicals inside of an iron air battery are around $1 per kilowatt hour.
So what does this technology actually look like? I'm thinking there's a large wind farm or solar power facility. Your battery sits next to it and takes that power. And when it's at capacity, it distributes it to the grid over time.
The actual battery units are just over a cubic meter. So they look, they're a little bit longer than that, but they look like a washing machine and a dryer together. And those are stacked into containerized type units that are organized into large scale grid infrastructure, and they connect to the grid at medium voltage. Very similar to what a lithium ion battery plant might look like. And I guess one of the key distinctions is that it would look like a lithium ion plant, except that you could get 100 hours instead of 4.
Okay, we've covered virtual power plants, we've covered iron air batteries. Now, a bit further along the pipeline, Quaise is a startup that intends to use the microwave drill for getting geothermal energy at a depth of up to 20 kilometers below the Earth's surface. For context, that would be almost twice as deep as the deepest hole that's ever been drilled. We welcome Kevin Bonebreak to the podcast.
Quaise is developing a new drilling technology that is based on high power, high frequency microwaves that to date have primarily been used in fusion experiments. And what we're doing specifically is we are using the microwaves to dielectrically heat and vaporize rock. And what that enables you to do is to go much deeper and hotter from a drilling perspective than existing drilling technologies allow. That is interesting from an energy transition perspective for two reasons. One, it enables you to pursue geothermal power developments anywhere on the planet. So you're not limited to places where heat is near the surface of the Earth. And two, because you're able to get to such hotter temperatures, and it enables you to produce much hotter steam, which dramatically improves your efficiencies and the power outputs of your wells.
I'm trying to visualize this process. Drilling, vaporizing rock, and pulling it out of the earth must create really high temperatures, requiring coolants and that sort of thing.
So if you think about how your microwave works in your kitchen, it's the same principle. So the microwave in your kitchen is oscillating molecules and imparting heat to them. We do the same thing, except we put so much heat into them that they vaporize into a gas. So at the bottom of the wellbore, all we have is a tube. There's no electronics, there's no moving parts. The microwaves, what we call millimeter waves, are propagating down that tube. They come out the end of it, they hit the rock, they vaporize the rock. And then we send compressed gas, either air or nitrogen, down the tube, and it circulates the vaporized rock back up the tube to the surface where we capture it.
It'll be really interesting to see how this pans out. When will the technology be ready?
We're about 5 years away from piloting a power plant right now.
So geothermal energy, this type of renewable energy taken from the Earth's core, seems to have a lot of advantages and requires a very small amount of land. I'm wondering then, why it doesn't get much more attention compared with solar and wind?
Traditional geothermals had a poor risk-return trade-off relative to other energy sources. And what I mean by that is there was a fair amount of exploration risk, where traditionally you would go to an area that had a high geothermal gradient and you would drill hoping to hit an aquifer of water that would capture that heat, that then had sufficient permeability that you could produce steam from it, but that heat was not as high as we're talking about it was hit or miss as to whether you would hit an actual aquifer that was actually useful that you could use for electricity generation. So we're getting around the risk in that we can drill anywhere. It's just a question of how deep we have to go. And then from a returns perspective, instead of producing steam that is a wet steam that's at 150 to 200 degrees Celsius, we're going to either produce superheated steam or supercritical water that will deliver much more energy, a lot more joules per wellbore. So it's going to improve your returns substantially. So higher returns and lower risk than what you've seen traditionally.
Virtual power plants, iron air batteries, and microwave drilling are just some of the technologies that can help mitigate the worst effects of climate change. And all these technologies can be used in developing countries to try to bridge the truly shocking energy gap between the lowest income countries and developed countries. Geothermal energy in particular is already well established in many developing countries.
Kenya actually produces 50% of their electricity from geothermal sources, and Indonesia is the third largest, third most active geothermal company on the planet. So we're certainly very bullish on developing countries. I think, like all of these technologies, our goal has to be, though, to get the technology to a point where it competes from an economic perspective without government subsidies.
Talking government subsidies, in the US at least, the recent Inflation Reduction Act has introduced tax credits that should be really helpful for renewable energy. We produced a recent Lasting Values episode dedicated to exploring the Inflation Reduction Act, which you can find on our Apple and Spotify channels. Bigger picture, I asked our experts if we're on the right path towards clean, low-carbon energy by 2050.
I am incredibly encouraged by the commitment that the U.S. government has made in both the infrastructure bill that passed 2 years ago and the Inflation Reduction Act that recently passed. So that's grants and loan program to support renewable energy technology development and tax credits to support scale up and market. If we didn't have that, I would be very pessimistic right now. Seeing that kind of a commitment from the U.S. government leaves me encouraged. And now to be on the path that you're talking about, we need to see similar commitments from the European governments, from Asian governments, because that's what it's going to take.
We can create scale that allows us to have an abundance of energy at half the price today that's more resilient and sustainable. But what's in the way is a political will to get there and all the complexities that go with it. So that political will would have to do things like have a single electricity market in the United States as opposed to the 9 wholesale power markets that we have in the US and Canada. I don't think we're going to solve for carbon zero anytime in the next 50 years. We're really probably solving for resilience against climate change. But the fact is the technology is there. It's just a political will we need.
Michael, do you feel optimistic that these and many other new technologies can keep us under 1.5 degrees of warming?
We know, of course, that the climate targets are in big trouble, but we need to consider that our climate targets are a self-fulfilling prophecy to some extent. If we believe that we can achieve our climate goals, then we will put the right money and incentives in place to reach our targets. If we don't believe climate change are achievable, then there's no reason to believe that we will. These things don't happen by themselves. So we have a lot of amount of agency here, and we know what we need to do.
Check in next month to discover more climate tech solutions that are flying under the radar. And follow us on Apple or Spotify. That's Lasting Values, the sustainability podcast by Credit Suisse.
Should a bank clean up the ocean? We engage with companies creating ocean impact and preventing plastic pollution practices. We're on it.
The information provided herein constitutes general marketing material. It is not investment advice, nor otherwise based on a consideration of the personal circumstances of the addressee, nor is it a result of objective or independent research. The information provided herein is not legally binding, and it does not constitute an offer or invitation to enter into any type of financial transaction. The information provided herein was produced by a member of Credit Suisse Group AG and or its affiliates, hereafter CS, with the greatest of care and to the best of its knowledge and belief. The information and views expressed herein are those of CS at the time of writing and are subject to change at any time without notice. They are derived from sources believed to be truthful and reliable. CS provides no guarantee with regard to the completeness and accuracy of the information, and where legally possible, does not accept liability for any direct, indirect, incidental, specific, or consequential losses that might arise from making use of the information. If nothing is indicated to the contrary, all figures are unaudited. The information provided herein is solely for information purposes and the exclusive use of the recipient, and is not intended and should not be construed as legal, accounting, tax, nor financial advice provided by CS. If this material is issued and distributed in the US, it is by CSSU, a member of NYSE, FINRA, SIPC, and the NFA, and CSSU accepts responsibility for its contents. Clients should contact their sales representative and execute transactions through a Credit Suisse subsidiary or affiliate in their home jurisdiction, unless governing law permits otherwise. This material is intended for institutional investors only, not for retail distribution. It may not be reproduced, neither in part nor in full, without the prior written permission of CS. Important information for investors in Germany. The information and views expressed herein are those of CS at the time of writing and are subject to change at any time without notice. They are derived from sources believed to be reliable. CS provides no guarantee with regard to the content and completeness of the information. If nothing is indicated to the contrary, all figures are unaudited. The information provided herein is for the exclusive use of the recipient. Copyright 2021 Credit Suisse Group AG and or its affiliates. All rights reserved.